Andrew McCarthy is well known to all of those who have any interest in the interpretation of the Islamic presence in the Western world and indeed in the United States, and who are concerned about that presence. Andrew McCarthy is a lawyer and was the prosecutor of the so-called Blind Sheikh. As you may remember, he and his cohort were the people who first bombed, with some significant effect, the World Trade Center, though they did not tear it down. He languishes these days in prison, but all of the Islamic world seems to be focused on getting him released and back to his rather special role in the Middle Eastern world. And now, Andrew McCarthy, who's done a number of very important books in the past, has a brand new one, Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy. Andrew, we have it, I think, from, I don't know whether it's the Bible or Shakespeare. Those two sources are often confused. But if winter comes, can spring be far behind?
Well, Milt, I think the problem is that spring is here, at least in name, but it certainly looks a lot more like winter and feels a lot more like winter and is foreboding in the way that winter is foreboding when we look at least at the Middle East.
Well, one of the cases where there was a good deal of hopefulness when the revolutionary events began to unroll is Egypt, where Mubarak seemed in many ways to be repressive and authoritarian in a way which had perhaps served Egypt's development at a difficult period. But that was no longer required. And the voice of young people eager for democracy and eager for social transformation was heard in the land, was heard in the souks of Cairo. There was some hopefulness about what was happening in Egypt at the time. Were you hopeful?
No, I was never hopeful. I actually think that, you know, as someone who studied Egypt for a long time, I prosecuted the Blind Sheikh, of course, as you mentioned, back in the early 1990s. His most infamous escapade, I guess, up until the Trade Center bombing, was issuing a fatwa that called for the killing of Sadat, who was Mubarak's predecessor. So I've kind of been a student of Egypt and jihadist movements in Egypt, the Egyptian population, et cetera, over the last 20 or so years. And while I think it's absolutely true, as you mentioned, that there were that there are people in Egypt who are pro-Western in orientation and who hope to foster something that was akin to the Western idea of democracy. Egypt, for the most part, is an Islamist population. The polling that was done in Egypt prior to the what's now called the Arab Spring and the elections that that took place in it indicated that upwards of two-thirds of Egypt's population said it wanted to be ruled under a strict interpretation of Sharia, which is Islam's societal system and legal code. And in the classic interpretation of it, which is the one that is mostly followed in Egypt, is a very repressive system. I'd also note that Mubarak, while he was everything you say, he was autocratic, and there's reason to believe that he looted the country of a great deal of its treasury. On the other hand, much of the criticism about Mubarak was that he was in the thrall of Western ideas about liberty and equality between the sexes, et cetera. Now, you know, I'm not trying to cast Mubarak in any way as anything like that we refer to as a libertarian. But on the other hand, in terms of the laws that he imposed regarding, for example, the rights and equality of women before the law, he was a lot more democratic and progressive than what has followed him.
Well, we know that the Muslim Brotherhood government is obviously not progressive and not prone to secularizing. But they've been rejected, have they not, by the general public with regard to some of their repressive innovations?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say that they've been rejected. There's a lot of dissent.
Well, they had to back away from some of the initiatives that they were planning to take.
Well, they did impose a Sharia constitution, which was the main thing that they wanted to accomplish. And while there is a great deal of dissent, at least loud dissent, I would point out that the Islamists won the first parliamentary election by a margin of about 78% to 22%. The actually significant development in that election was that the Salafist parties, so-called, which are more rabid for Sharia change even than the Brotherhood is, polled better than the progressives and the authentic Democrats. They actually, they got about 25% of the electorate versus 22% for the Democratic forces. And in the last election where Sharia was imposed as part of the Constitution, again, that election was won by the Islamists by about a 4-1 margin.
As you examine the whole range of countries caught up in the so-called Arab Spring, do you have essentially the same pattern? That is, that they are going in the orthodox, conservative, even fanatic direction with regard to imposing heavy Sharia restrictions and upon the general population, and perhaps even pursuing expansionist ambitions, as, for example, in the case of Egypt, and its influence on other countries, and what it will be doing in terms of its long-term relations with Israel. Is it a situation in the Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim world that, as it was, shall ever be, world without end, amen?
Well, no, I don't think that, you know, I don't think it's necessarily that way. I think for sure in this phase right now, things are certainly trending in the direction of more authoritarian Sharia. I don't think there's any doubt that that's the case. On the other hand, I would never take the position that that you know something cannot change and that there cannot be reform. But I do think that reform is the work of generations. It's not something that you know that we're going to see you know happen in one Arab Spring, which in reality has actually turned things in a negative direction for people who care about authentic democracy as opposed to the facade of democracy that's been the feature of the Arab Spring.
Well, it could it be argued if you go to the Islamic source, if you go to the Quran and if you go to the Hadith and so on, that in fact you find no scriptural support for secularizing and for movement in the so-called democratic direction, that strict Salafist-like imposed Sharia law is built into the very nature of the religion and thus built into the very nature of the movements now represented in the so-called Arab Spring.
I think there's a strong argument that is true, and that certainly is the mainstream Islam of the Middle East. On the other hand, there are people who I think have an interpretation of Islam that is not a far-fetched one, which says, for example, that Islam actually anticipates having non-Muslims live in the Islamic State. Now, you know, if you look at Surah 9, which is the ninth chapter of the Quran and one of the last ones that actually is written, the suggestion is that you know, non-Muslims can live if they submit to the authority of the Muslim state and pay tribute and agree to live in this depressed condition as this sort of lower dhimmi caste.
Yeah, that's a special social status. The dhimmi and dhimmitude defines the non-Muslim living in the Muslim world.
Yes, but the reformist Muslim, I think, takes the position that this at least demonstrates that the Quran doesn't demand that everybody become a Muslim, does have the possibility of at least pluralist societies. They obviously have to wrestle with the supremacist tendency of the scriptures. But again, am I going to say that this could never reform? I think it would be silly to say that because there are places where Islam has been interpreted in a fairly moderate way, and where the practice of Islam differs vastly from the general practice in the Middle East.
Well, there is the great question of what the ultimate purpose of Islamic states, and for that matter of Islamic communities, is. What we have in the West is considerable stress on certain particular passages from the Quran, for example, and we tend to say that Islam, contemporary Islam, is living up to what you have in the Quran, say, 8:39. Quote, so fight them until there is no more fitna, that is, disbelief by non-Muslims, and all submit to the religion of Allah alone in the whole world. Or another one, fight them and Allah will punish them by your hands. Lay them low and cover them with shame. He will help you over them. Is that really a built-in imperative in eternal Islam?
Well, it depends on whether there is an eternal Islam, and I don't mean to play loyally games with words. What I mean by that is there are different interpretations of Islam. There is the straightforward literal one that reads the things that you just read, and many other verses like them. There are over 100 verses in the Quran that endorse violent jihad. And say that these are injunctions for all time, and they mean exactly what they say. There are other interpretations of Islam which construe this differently. They contextualize it. I guess that's the popular term for it. They say that these injunctions were for their place and time and are not operative anymore, or at least they're only operative if certain conditions apply that are not in existence at the moment. Now, I think that interpretation has a very uphill climb, because it's odd that to argue that an eternal God somehow had a preternatural interest in the 7th century, such that, you know, he issued all kinds of commands that were pertinent only to that time and that time alone. I mean, to me, that's a tough road to hoe.
I came to the University of Chicago a long time ago, and shortly thereafter encountered a very distinguished member of the faculty. I forget whether his first name was Ahmed or something else, but Rahman, who was an historian of Islam and himself of the faith, but convinced that the faith had been misunderstood and that modern Islam has every reason and every substantive basis in its long tradition if not to secularize, at least to be fully open to other peoples of the book and more broadly to the human enterprise, and that the prophetic force calling for jihad and for armed intrusion into the world was, if it ever had held any meaning and held any attractive, compelling meaning at all, was long since invalidated by contemporary experience. He was, in essence, a great reformist in what he wrote and what he said. And surely there are lots of others in the Islamic world who do the same these days. I've talked to a number of others as we've had them on the radio program.
Yeah, well, there's no question that those people are out there. I think the problem that you have, Milt, is that many of the most influential institutions in Islam, particularly those in the Middle East. I mean, I'm thinking along the lines of Al-Azhar University, which has been the seat of Sunni learning since the 10th century. The Muslim Brotherhood, which is the most important mass Islamic movement in the world. These very influential institutions, and there are other persons who are very influential as well, people like Sheikh Yusuf Karadawi, who is the Muslim Brotherhood's top jurist and is basically an international TV star because of a popular broadcast of his about Sharia law that's on Al Jazeera television. These sources are really relying on Islam that's quite literal and supremacist, and I think it's difficult for reformers to battle that. They certainly haven't done it from where I sit in a very compelling way. And I would like to see them win. So, you know, the last thing I want to do is be overly pessimistic about their chances. But I think we have to be realistic about the fact that the most influential institutions, Sunni and Shiite, in Islam today are adherent to the supremacist construction of Islam.
Then the question that absolutely forces itself upon us, if we're interested in historical analysis, is why did it take that turn? When did it take that turn? And why did it take that turn? The supremacist reinterpretation of, or the supremacist definition of Islam and its mission. I think of the works of Bernard Lewis, and he has addressed that issue and tried to make sense of it all. We're about to stop right now for a quick break with a word or two from some friends. And then I want to persist with that question. What accounts for the turn that Islam took in the last 20 or 30 years in the Islamic world and in the Western world? Directly back to Andrew McCarthy after this. And we return to conversation with Andrew McCarthy, really generally distinguished as one of the leading interpreters of the strenuous, assertive style in contemporary Islam, which is jihadist and Salafist and makes a lot of trouble, not only in the countries in which they have attained or re-attained power, but also, of course, for the Western world, which faces Islam. And they may very well be confirming the prediction of Sam Huntington and others that a clash of civilizations between East and West, between Islam and the remnant of Christendom, is inevitable and is now being enacted. All of that is summarized in Andrew's fine new book, Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy. So behind the illusion is the reality of a rejection of democracy and an insistence upon rigid interpretation of the actual literalist meaning of much of the scriptural material that is the base for Islam. Is that a modern turn? And if so, what accounts for that turn having been taken?
Milt, I think it goes back to the 1920s, really, yeah, where the two most important strains in what we see in the modern Sunni Islamist world or Islamic world can be seen. This is the square off between Ataturk in Turkey and Bana, who was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Ataturk looked at the dissolute post-World War I position of the Islamic world and made a decision that the only way for a flourishing society, the kind of Turkey that he wanted to see, would be a turn to the West. And that would require, and it's interesting he felt this way because he was a Muslim himself, that would require a repression of Sharia as far as the public square was concerned. So, of course, it did not become illegal in any sense to be a Muslim, but you had something that was much more akin to the Western idea of a division between secular and spiritual life. You had state intrusion into religious life in this plenary Muslim country, so that the state basically exercised a great deal of control over the mosques, what was preached in the mosques, what was read in the mosques, the training of imams and the like. Kemal Ataturk backed that up with the military as the ultimate check on the secular order that he was that he had fostered, so that knowing that it was in a country like Turkey, it was always possible to have uprising of Islamists. The military was there as a failsafe to make sure that if things started to teeter toward the Islamist end of things, the military could jump in and stop that, which they actually did about four times in Turkey's history in military coups, where the military actually took over and ruled and restored the Kemalist order. At the same time, Bana in the 1920s looked at what Kemal Ataturk was doing in Turkey and was horrified by it, because he concluded that the problem in the Muslim world was not too much Islam, but not enough Islam, and not enough in particular of the right kind of Islam. He was a Salafist, Bana, and you know, he wanted this sort of restoration of the traditions of the early founding generations of Islam. There's a big difference, I think, between the Brotherhood and the Saudi Wahhabist traditions. The Brotherhood were not anti-knowledge or anti-science or even anti-modernist so much as they wanted to control the future and control those things as a means of establishing Islamic supremacy.
Is that the distinction obtaining still to this present moment between Salafism and Wahhabism?
Well, there are other distinctions between them, but I think that, you know, the most important distinction between those Egyptians who were in the Brotherhood's Salafist tradition and the Saudi Wahhabist tradition is that the Brotherhood men were and not just men but the women as well were educated, urbane, sophisticated characters. Mm-hmm. Bana was an educator. He had a very well thought through, ground up plan for revolution that, you know, unlike the sort of extortionate, flat out terrorist Al Qaeda kind, saw terrorism as just one item on a very broad menu, where every institution of a society was to be put under pressure in order to advance the idea of establishing a Muslim state by gradually opening the way to Sharia being installed. It was a very different program from what the Wahhabists wanted.
Let me ask you to do a kind of tour of the horizon. We focus on Egypt and somewhat on Turkey. If you look at all the nations of the North African littoral and on into Asia Minor, as far as necessarily including Iraq and Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, etc. Are there any significant distinctions with regard to the extent to which they are dependent upon militant Islam?
Well, I think Turkey is the most interesting country of all of them, and it's actually not a good sign for how we'd like things to go, because I think Turkey was the country where you had the best chance of a successful democracy taking root in an Islamic society. Turkey is a country that has always had one foot in Europe. It's not an Arabic country. It has always had a relationship with the Western world that's been more open than the relationship that the Arab countries have.
And Ataturk's revolution goes way back to what, the second decade of the 20th century.
That's exactly right, which is, by the way, coterminous with the history of the Muslim Brotherhood as well. Mm-hmm. It's amazing that two guys who were as significant and sophisticated as Bana and Ataturk could look at exactly the same world and draw diametrically opposed conclusions about what ailed it.
But let me ask you quickly to look at some of those other countries. The so-called Arab Spring began in Tunisia. How does Tunisia stand right now? What about Libya? What about Algeria, if they are involved at all? After all, they are in North Africa. And then on a quick hop across a piece of the Mediterranean, and we're in heavy territory.
Well, I think Tunisia is trending toward Muslim Brotherhood interpretation of, Sharia, the Ennahda party in particular. North Africa as a whole is having terrible problems right now because the aftermath of the war in Libya is that a lot of Gaddafi's arsenals were not properly safeguarded, and as a result, while he didn't have nuclear weapons any longer or much of a weapons of mass destruction program, he did have a considerable arsenal. A lot of those weapons have fallen into the hands of jihadists across North Africa, which is why that's such a mess right now.
Are there jihadists in partial control in Libya at the moment?
Well, certainly in parts of Libya. I mean, we saw that. I think what we've seen in Benghazi in particular tells us a lot about Libya. I mean, Benghazi before there was this this war to topple Gaddafi, Benghazi was known as the capital of the jihad in Libya. It sent more fighters to against the U.S. troops in Iraq than any other country did per capita. And it was part of the reason why we brought Gaddafi in from the cold to give us intelligence on those folks.
Across the Suez, we're into the other great bastion of Arab power, namely Saudi Arabia. What are they after? And similarly, one must ask about the Shiite-Sunni division and the great Shiite power, namely Iran. What are they after?
Well, I think they're all after a worldwide caliphate under their own control and under their own interpretation.
Worldwide. They really mean that and think that.
They certainly do. In fact,
including the United States.
Yes. So Saudi Arabia is the number one exporter of Islamist ideology of any country in the world. They've spent billions and billions of dollars and combined with the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the West in order to install a program of the gradual implementation, acceptance and implementation of Sharia in Western countries. And they've been fabulously successful.
We're about to pause for just another quick message from a friend and then directly back. And as we come back, the question is the West endangered, as some argue it is, I think as you do, by the very presence of Salafist and Wahhabist Islam, and by the general sentiment in favor of those extremes the populations of much of the Muslim world? And are they moving? Are they, in fact, having targeted us, because you say they have, are they, in fact, getting closer to hitting the target? Directly back to Andrew McCarthy after this. And we return to conversation with Andrew McCarthy, author most recently of a very important new book, Spring Fever, The Illusion, Underline Illusion of Islamic Democracy. So it's not Islamic democracy. You say, in fact, it is Islamic ambition for the creation of a general control over the world through the proselytizing of the West so that they're going to turn most of us into Muslims. Is that really the plan?
Well, they don't necessarily have to turn us into Muslims, as we talked about before. They'll accept non-Muslims as long as there's submission to the authority of Sharia. And that's what they're really looking for, is a gradual acceptance and implementation of Sharia. And
well, however, is the scenario as they envision it with regard to England, with regard to Germany, with regard to the United States?
Well, it's a strategy that is a very long-term strategy, but it's working remarkably well. And it's called voluntary apartheid. That's the description that's been given to it, and I think it's apt. The idea is that Muslims move into a non-Muslim country and establish enclaves, physical areas where Muslims move into.
Dearborn, Michigan.
Sure, but there are a number of them throughout. Europe is dotted with what we call no-go zones, which are places that the authorities no longer go into.
Well, yes,
basically, they've ceded authority to the local Muslim imams and jurists in those.
As for example, the banlieue of Paris, the suburbs of Paris.
Yes, and this is exactly what the strategy is. The idea is to establish these enclaves. Bana's ideology teaches that the mosque and the Islamic community center in every town is supposed to be what he called the axis of the movement. And that is what was supposed to draw Muslims and sustain them to be a center for training. And that meant intellectual training as well as physical
training. But look, isn't there something working against that? Let's look to the United States. If you go to Dearborn, or if you go, for that matter, to Chicago, where there's a large Islamic presence, if you hit the third and even the fourth generation, and these are Americanized young people, haven't the special appeals of Salafist expansionism, haven't those appeals begin to fade?
Well, no. I think actually what we're seeing is the opposite. As you get through successive generations, you go from many people who came to the West because they wanted to live Western lives, that they didn't want to be prisoners of a Sharia society. And as time has gone on, and as just generations have gone by, the opposite trend has taken place.
So the filial generation becomes more Islamist than the parental generation.
Yeah, and I think that's a natural thing to happen if you move into a culture that is no longer proud of itself. The young people gravitate to something that's strong and gives them direction, and that is what Islamic supremacism does.
And a quick zero into Boston and the marathon. Would that sort of event, not merely in Boston, though that was a horrific event, but on London, in the London tubes and all over the Western world, that kind of terrorism, that kind of assault, profligate assault on whatever people might be handy to be killed, is that tactically intended for the general victory of Islam? Or is this just kids going crazy?
Well, I think there's a more complex explanation of it, which is that the Islamists of the Muslim Brotherhood stripe, who are hardly anti-terrorism, I mean, Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood's branch in the Palestinian territories, mm-hmm. But they're much more tactical about terrorism, and they do a cost-benefit analysis about it, and they are against terrorism in the West. Because it's actually counterproductive to them. It sort of opens the spotlight of the authorities onto their activities.
So how does that terrorism in the West happen to occur?
Well, it occurs because, number one, there is an unmistakable strain in Islamic scripture that is pro-terrorism. The Brotherhood itself is pro-terrorism, so it's difficult for it to be condemnatory of terrorism. Mm-hmm. For example, someone like Kara Dawi, who condemned the 9/11 attacks, also issued a fatwa calling for terrorist attacks against American troops in Iraq. So it's not like they're speaking with a clear anti-terrorism voice.
It sounds as if we're engaged in what might have been called a long twilight struggle between these two opposed civilizations. You know there are many who disagree. When it comes to people who are supposedly Islamist, are scholars of Islam, do we get more of the sort of view that you represent from journalists on the scene than we do from the academics in the Middle Eastern studies departments and so on?
Well, I think that may be because, Milt, I don't purport to be a scholar. My concern is the national security of the United States.
Quite properly, yes.
I don't really care if the Islamic supremacists have the truer or more authentic interpretation of Sharia. The only thing that matters to me is it's a mainstream interpretation that many Muslims adhere to, and it's dangerous to our society.
Therefore, to strike the tone set by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin in a pamphlet famously titled, What is to be Done? This, you tend to see this as that long twilight struggle. How do we comport ourselves from here to the middle of the century or beyond?
Well, we have to get rid of political correctness when it comes to this issue.
Uh-huh.
I am not in favor of doing things like the French do, where, you know, you end up banning the burqa and traducing your own traditions. What I believe in is the light of day, which is that we have to have this out in the open. We have to talk about it. We have to talk about what Islamic supremacists believe. And if we're ever going to empower authentic Muslim moderates, they have to have a forum in which to marginalize the supremacists. The only way I think you can do that is force them out in the open to acknowledge what they believe in and defend it.
What do you get from relevant American politicians in that regard, or for that matter, from West European politicians?
I think they're mainly scared to death of it. They've been mau-mau'd into the demagoguery about Islamophobia and the idea that they're racist and the like. Really creates a lot of cravenness, I'm afraid, in our political class.
Islamophobia is as evil as homophobia to them.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I equate the two, but I will say that Islamophobia, in particular, is a fraud and is mainly a term that was invented by the Muslim Brotherhood to do exactly what it's done, which is prevent people from inquiring into their ideology.
Time's almost up, but I can't resist asking you the impossible. Are you confident or pessimistic about the ultimate outcome?
I always go back to Churchill's famous, one of his many famous axioms that, Americans always do the right thing once they've exhausted every other possibility. And with that as my guideline, I am hopeful that, eventually we'll see that we cannot continue to investigate this along the lines of dividing ideology from action, so that, you know, you have a situation like the Boston Marathon bombing, where the FBI won't surveil a guy because even though they found out that he's an Islamic radical, he hasn't done anything bad yet.
Yeah.
You know, I think we'll eventually realize that we have to take account of ideology.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us today. And this has been quite an illuminating discussion. Let's just quickly add once again that the new book is titled Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy. Hope to talk to you again soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Milt. Thank you.